Welcome to another episode of the Half-Life Show. I'm Vikram.
And I'm Subbu.
Subbu, so what's with the dark title for this episode?
Okay, so for this episode, we're going to talk about this book called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. And according to the title of this book, we all have about 4,000 weeks of life in us, right? Assuming you live until 80 years of age. And that means we both have about 2,000 weeks left because we are already approaching our 40s.
That's it. 2,000 weeks to go.
Yeah, 2,000 weeks to go. So this idea of 4,000 weeks and looking at life this way, putting a number on it, at first it might seem depressing and it may seem like a negative way to look at life. But the premise of this book is that if you just accept the fact that life is short and this is all the time you have, and you won't achieve everything that you want to do in life, then once you accept this and you imbibe it into your bones, then you can actually go about living a more meaningful life and you can plan your life accordingly so that you're just happy at the end of your journey. Instead of doing a quote-unquote book review, we're going to try doing something different today, right? When you look at all the ideas that are presented in this book, what we decided is that you can broadly classify them into three buckets. So the ideas that he's presenting falls either into the productivity bucket, or he's talking about time, or he's talking about attention. So productivity, time, and attention. So those are the three buckets. So we're going to walk through each of these buckets, and we're just going to, you know, we'll do a you go, I go kind of a format and exchange, you know, what our takeaway was in each of these three buckets. How does that sound?
Sounds good. Oliver Berkman actually has written quite a few books, I realized, when I was looking through the other stuff he's written, but 4,000 weeks has a catchphrase also, and it is basically time management for mortals. So it's like a productivity book that is different, that accounts for how finite our lives are. And that's what I think makes this book different from all the other productivity books out there, and has gained quite a good following online. There are a lot of people talking about this book, which is how we got into reading it too. So let's go through the three buckets you described. So productivity was the first one you mentioned, right? One really nice analogy from this book that we both read is that he looks at life as a conveyor belt. And along the conveyor belt, you know, what keeps coming on the belt is various tasks. So as the tasks keep coming, you keep working on them. And then the next task comes on the conveyor belt, and so on and so forth. Now, the typical approach to productivity and what everybody generally talks about is like, how do you get most number of things done in as little time as possible? Which is akin to saying, how can you get, you know, each task done on this box on the conveyor belt as quickly as possible so you can get to the next box, and, you know, so on and so forth. However, in reality, what ends up happening is that as we keep going through these conveyor belt tasks, we find that the conveyor belt is now moving faster. So now there are more tasks coming at you, and you are now, you know, stuck for even more productivity hacks, which you try to then use and get each task done really quickly. So what happens as this conveyor belt goes on and on and on is like a feedback loop between you working harder, your stress and anxiety building, and ultimately leading to burnout and, you know, failure of health and mental condition. So this is a nice analogy for like why productivity viewed through a traditional lens is not the ideal way of viewing it, given our finite lifespan.
Yeah. And the conveyor belt analogy is further compounded by this notion that if you're just picking off things one after the other and just working off of the conveyor belt, there's also this problem of you get the wrong things done. I think we don't need this book to really tell us that life is short. Like, we all know this. I mean, especially people like us in the 30s, in 40s and so on, we all know that we don't have much time and life is short. But even after knowing that, there is this kind of a conundrum that we all still choose to get the wrong things done. And what this author says is that, you know, the real problem isn't our limited time. The real problem is that we all have unwittingly inherited, we feel pressured to live by a troublesome set of ideas about how to use our limited time. And all of this just makes things worse. So, you know, you start in kindergarten, then you go to your elementary, middle, high school, and so on. And we all come out of the education system with a certain framework of how we should live our life and how we should prioritize the tasks. Even though you know that, hey, I should be, the right thing to do is not to get to inbox zero, right? That in getting to inbox zero is a waste of time, because when the day turns around, you'll have another 1,000 emails the next day, and you're never going to get off the conveyor belt and do things which you know are more meaningful, like spending time with family, traveling, seeing the world, gaining experiences, and so on.
There is a beautiful, you know, couple of words that describes this, right? Like memento mori, which means remember that you will die. So there are, many people who have this as a central part of their lives, where in a particular journal, they mark off each week as it goes by. And so you see your life drain like a battery on your cell phone, you know, and that gives you perspective as to, you know, how each week that goes by is so important. And it's not just something to be trifled with.
Yeah, yeah. And also there is this kind of a touching quote by Charles Eisenstein. This is, again, straight from the book. He says that life, the life I knew, was supposed to be more joyous than this. It was supposed to be more real, more meaningful, and the world was supposed to be more beautiful. We were not supposed to hate Mondays and live for the weekends and holidays. We were not supposed to have to raise our hands to be aloft to pee. We were not supposed to be kept indoors on a beautiful day, day after day. It hits you in your bones in some ways, because this is a really good quote. I almost want to print it out and put it on my wall, because I think this needs to be a constant reminder, in the sense that usually what happens with me is I read beautiful sentences like this, which really hit deep. And it's kind of a call to reprioritize and rethink your life. But then it is so easy to, I'll have maybe 3 days of clarity, and then I get back on the conveyor belt. Now, have you thought about this problem? I mean, for me, this is probably one of the biggest problems I face, which is I know I want to introduce change in my life, but that conveyor belt, it's almost like unintentionally my attention goes back to that, and I start the stuff that I know I should deprioritize, things like not trying to answer all of my emails or whatever. I just gravitate back towards that form of a life. How do you handle this?
That happens to everybody. So one of the ways we can handle this is, you know, to live it, you know, to live every moment intentionally, to know exactly what you are doing. And this book speaks about that, as in, don't go into like autopilot mode. Don't start to coast. Because when you start to go into autopilot mode and not living with intention, you end up going back to the old habits you've developed over all these years, right? And building habits takes a long time. So by living with intention and asking yourself, what am I supposed to be doing now that is, you know, of most value to either my work, my family, or myself? Only then can we break out of that mindset of just going into autopilot, right? I know, going back to what you said about how, as we went through as children, you know, and grew up to become adults we are today, somehow we were always told that you work today for a better tomorrow, right? You know, in middle school, they told us, go to high school, you're going to have a really, you know, hard set of tests and exams coming up, you're going to do that. After that, they're like, you got to go to college, because only a college degree is going to get you, you know, the better future. When it comes to a job, they're like, okay, you better start working hard, because only then can you get a promotion and then, you know, get a lot of money and retire happily. You know, so this is like a carrot we are chasing all our lives. And never do we stop to think, this is it. This is the life you are living, you know. And we'll probably go back to this topic when we go talk about attention. But essentially what life is not about, always about eating and sleeping. And you know, that is a necessary part of the biology of our species. But this is life. The every moment that we pay attention to is what life is. It is a sum of all the moments that are happening right now, right?
Yeah. Okay. So to close out this productivity bucket, right? Now, you and I, we have been productivity junkies. If you, especially if you rewind back in the last 2 years, we did fall into this category of trying to plan out your whole day, plan out the whole week, and just try to get as much done as possible. Like our mindset was, hey, I have office work, I have these three hobbies, and then I have time, I need to spend time with family. And you would wake up at what, 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. Until you go to work, you would do your hobbies, then send the kids off to school, go to work, come back, put the kids back to bed, and then go back to your hobbies, right? And we, there is no other way to put it. We were productivity junkies, right? And I think after reading this book, I kind of feel like I need a little bit of rehabilitation. And I feel like I need to change my mindset. So how do you feel from your productivity junkie days?
I actually agree with a lot of what you said. That's how exactly how I used to go about my day too. But now what it has become is that I'm trying not to become a driven individual. You know, what society celebrates as being a driven individual, a highly ambitious individual who dedicates every moment of his or her waking life towards a particular task. I think that's good to do, but it has become an addiction. And the book talks about this too, because we are constantly pushing ourselves to become better for some form of tomorrow, which we don't know if it's even going to come. I mean, not to sound too depressing, but, you know, since one never knows what's going to happen, you know, don't live too much for the future, live for today. And the other thing is that we seem to be in a constant flight mode from our own minds. And in the sense that we don't sit down for a moment and do nothing. And we'll come back to this when we talk about time or attention later and what it means to, you know, actually get rest. But we don't do that. The moment we are, you know, quiet for a minute, we're like, okay, now is a good time to catch up on task A. Oh, let me reply to messages. Oh, I have a few minutes at the grocery line. Let me just check my Instagram messages or see what's going on there. So boredom is not a thing anymore. We do not tolerate boredom because there is such a low barrier to entertain yourself or to distract yourself into something else. So we are constantly running from ourselves. So that is something that we all have to stop doing, I think, and just live in the moment, you know, observe and take in the sights and sounds of what is around you in that moment.
Yeah, actually, you bring up a good point. So one of the added problems of the kind of productivity junkie that I was is I have to be honest with myself and recognize the fact that when I say I'm a productivity junkie, I'm basically stacking up my day, trying to do as much as possible through the day. But the added problem is that everything I do in a day is has this underlying assumption that I'll get something out of it in the future. So if I do my hobbies in the morning or if I do something in the evening after the kid goes to bed, I'm kind of doing it because I feel like, hey, there is a reward behind this. There's some sort of future reward behind this. I'm not technically enjoying it for what it is in the present. So that is on productivity, right? And the next bucket is, should we do time?
Let's do time. This is an interesting thing. And, you know, we already touched upon it in the sense that time is always, we have been told, money. So we've been monetizing it, instrumentalizing it, and using it as a resource when it's not something you can store. Okay, a resource should be something sometimes you should be able to store. If you have a lot of grain, you store it in a silo, right? Time is not something you can store, but still we end up viewing it as a resource. This is a byproduct or a consequence of our industrial era. You know, the Industrial Revolution, because it was only then that people started working in factories, and then they decided that everybody has to come in at a certain time, because in a factory, you know, there's like one process goes to another. So unless everybody shows up at the same time, it doesn't make any sense running a factory. So they go, you know, everybody shows up at a certain time, and they decided the 8-hour workday is what everybody must do for 5 days a week. So that's how it came about. And so the book has some funny stories and how a particular industrialist actually accused his employees of stealing from him because they weren't working all the 8 hours, right? So it's like he thinks that it's actually a form of stealing. It is so it's viewing it as so much of a resource that, you know, it's kind of weird to look at it that way. But that's what it is. And, you know, before that, in the medieval times, we didn't really go like that. I mean, when people were like farming and things like that, you know, you go in, you do what you do, and you leave. You can't make the plants grow any faster. I mean, there's no point harvesting any further than what you're supposed to do in a day. I mean, because there's storage issues, there are all kinds of issues that doesn't make sense. So everybody lived for the moment until the industrial era came along. So ever since we have started instrumentalizing time, we view it as something we should use. Right now, if I'm just sitting here doing literally nothing, I feel like I'm wasting time. Look, I'm not doing anything with it. What am I doing? Oh, time is getting wasted. Or when I try to do too much and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so burnt out. I'm so busy. I don't have time for anything else. So this pendulum swings either way all the time, right? So that's where I think time is an important resource, because we have, or at least we view it as an important resource. We want to use it all the time. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, totally. So we did specifically talk about time in one of our previous episodes. It's called 5 Ways to Create Time. I forget which episode number we link it. And so this whole idea of what does time mean has been at the back of our mind. We have been trying to discuss and debate and try to characterize it in a better way for our own self in our, you know, private conversations on the phone. A couple of good points, right? I mean, apart from time being a resource and looking at from that angle is kind of problematic, the other point is this concept of deep time. So not only is time a resource, but if you look at how, say you spend time doing one of your hobbies, right? So you are doing what you are spending time on something that you like, but the problem is that you are so distracted that you are not fully immersed into what you're doing. And this book introduces this concept of deep time, which I really liked. And there's this quote which said, so we occasionally encounter deep time today. In those moments, when we slip into a realm where there is enough of everything, where we are not trying to fill a void in ourselves or the world. The boundary separating the self from the rest of reality grows blurry and time stands still. The clock does not stop, of course, but we do not hear it ticking. There is this issue of how you're using time and how others are trying to get your time out of you. If you look at time yourself, your ideal state of mind should be that as much as possible, you should try to experience deep time. And what that really means is that the time is going on, but you don't hear the clock ticking. So that really stuck in my head.
What that means is you're so immersed in what you're doing and enjoying what you're doing that you don't realize that time is slipping by you. So you're not staring at the clock constantly waiting for this unhappy moment to end, which can be the case in a lot of people's like work lives where they can't wait to get back out of this office and into their comfortable homes and relax for the rest of the day, right?
Correct. And also to go back to your the issue with managers and the business owners claim that people were stealing from them by not working in the paid time. So, okay, fine. You know, this is a society we live in. While we are throwing stones at it and saying, hey, this whole issue of we trading our time for money is kind of a problematic exchange. He's also saying, I'm not saying that we got to go back to our medieval ages, right? I mean, that's not a...
There were other problems, yes.
Many other problems as well. But I don't know if he says, I mean, he gives a like a solution or a like a positive way to look at this. I mean, we are exchanging our time for money, and that is that. That's how society is set up, and there is no real way around it.
I think his point is to stop viewing it so much of a resource. I know it's something that is finite, but it's something that you cannot store. Instead, live each moment for itself and do what is appropriate for you at that moment. Don't keep planning for the future. Be where you are. Be present. Don't be overly ambitious. Don't set yourself a standard that you cannot meet up to. Like, don't set up a productivity standard that is far more than what you can even achieve and try to blast towards that. He says, restrict what your capabilities are and learn to say no to things because you just don't have time for them. And keep your to-do list limited. Of course, do keep an unlimited list, like I mentioned in the last episode. This was inspired by him. But at what you can tackle at any given time has to be limited. And you cannot keep adding to that list. And this is accepting the limit, the finite nature of your own life and the finite things you can do in it. Even in terms of ambitions of where you want to travel, etc., you cannot go to every possible place in the world. And so there's no point of having a fear of missing out just because you didn't go to Paris your whole life. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of people have gone, but if you never get to go, that's perfectly reasonable because there's only this many hours and this many years and this many weeks, you know, in your life. So I think that's how he addresses time as a resource thing.
Cool. So this is great, right? This is really good because we're talking about time, but even there are three distinct flavors of time that he's trying to bring out. One of them is time as a resource, right? We spoke about that enough. The other one is deep time, right? So where you're immersing yourself at a deeper level and experiencing time in a better way. And there is one more flavor of time, which is the last time. So this is a quote from Sam Harris, where he says that our lives, thanks to their finitude, are inevitably full of activities that we are doing for the very last time. Just as there will be a final occasion on which I pick up my son, there will be a last time when you visit your childhood home or swim in the ocean or make love or have a deep conversation with a close friend. Yet, usually there'll be no way to know in the moment itself if you're doing this for the last time. So Sam Harris points out that we should therefore try to treat every experience with a certain reverence, with an understanding that, hey, this could be the last time. So this is, again, a pretty grim kind of an approach, but important one.
I want to add one more flavor of time, I think, that the book addresses. And that is individual versus community time. So there is this really nice concept that time is a networked good. And by that, I mean, it's only useful if there is somebody else who also has this good, you know, this item. For example, another network good is a telephone. There is no use in just you having a phone if there's nobody else to talk to with the phone. What are you going to do with the phone, right? Time is like that. There is a limit on how much time you can spend individually. There is an upper limit because after that, there is no happiness because people need a society to live in. So he suggests that you split up your time between individual and community time. You know, spending time in community gives you a certain sense of belonging and deep time that you mentioned earlier by just, you know, being in prayer, for example, or doing things as a community. He cites this example in Sweden, they have the concept of fika. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, where everybody gets together in the morning for coffee and cake. And it is something that you are expected to show up for. It's offensive if you miss it, because it seems like you don't value your community kind of a thing. And so that keeps people very happy because they get it's a time that you don't get to yourself. You're not going to be productive. You're not going to do anything. But the fact that you spend it with your community is very important. Contrary to this example, they tried in USSR, which is another story in the book, where they said, like, look, the optimal way to get productivity in a society is to stagger everybody's schedules. You give each person a different day of the week as a holiday. So that way, factories can run 24/7. This turned out to be a total disaster because people had time. They had free time. You know, it's not like they didn't have a day off from work. They did. But what ended up happening, even in the same household, is that the husband is not there and the wife is not there at the same time. So it was a major source of unhappiness. It's all not about efficiency, you know. So this is the fourth time, I would say. Flavor of time.
That is amazing. That is great. Actually, this story about the Soviet Union, I didn't know about this. It's such an interesting concept. It's amazing that they even tried this. And I don't know if, I mean, this probably led to, you know, you're essentially, society kind of implodes in itself. It just makes a whole bunch of unhappy campers. Okay, so we spoke about productivity. We spoke about time. The last bucket is attention. So what does Oliver Berkman have to say about attention?
Okay, the one thing I really like in this section of the book, in attention, is what he calls the art of creative neglect. I love this concept, okay? Because this is exactly what we need. And this is something I've started putting to use immediately. The idea is that you have to learn to say no, and not only say no, just neglect certain things certain times. Like your example of emails. Inbox zero implies that you are reading every email and giving attention to it. That's not possible. Neglect. But neglect what is important to neglect, and, you know, don't neglect what is important otherwise. So the one really good tip that I got from this section of the book is pay yourself first in terms of time. Now, we've heard this in the investing world where they say, okay, you earn money, save. Pay yourself first, save your money. And then, of course, you have to spend and things like that. The same concept applied to time is really amazing to me, because always, you know, you have a certain best hour of the day. It might be different things for different people. For me, it's early in the morning. I'm the kind of guy who gets up at like 5 a.m. and I'm refreshed. And that's my best hour of the day. So what I have started doing is that I have started dedicating the prime hour of my day, hour or hours of my day, to activities that I deem most important. Of course, this may change. Some days it might be my day job. I need to get something done. I need to focus on this particular thing. And I do that. Some days it might be, creative endeavors. Like this podcast, maybe you sit down and think about, you know, what we're going to talk about in this podcast. So I really love that idea. It's not always that you have to give your best hour to work or anything like that. You can decide how you want to pay yourself first in terms of time, which I really love. The second thing is, I think we both can really use this advice, is to limit the number of concurrent projects. Because we are notorious for having so many ambitions and trying to do so many things at the same time. It becomes too much. You know, you cannot play music, run a podcast, try to have a YouTube channel, have a day job, have a family. No, it's just too much. It's too much, you know. So you have to say no to it. You cannot leave it half finished. So either you complete it or you abandon it and you move on, right? And I think this was like a Charlie Munger thing where he said, you know, I don't know, you want to do 25 things, write them all out in a piece of paper. And then he says, start scratching everything out and stop when you have only 5 things left that you want to do. So I know you want to do more stuff. You just cannot get there. So pick the top 5 of the top 25 you want to do, and that's what you're going to stick with. So I really like this art of creative neglect that he has mentioned in this book. It's something I'm putting to use like immediately.
One of the things that is catching steam in social media these days is turning FOMO into JOMO. So there's a decent number of people are saying, hey, instead of looking at it as fear of missing out, think of it as joy of missing out.
Oh, okay. J is joy. Okay, now it rings a bell.
you put a positive spin on it and say that, hey, I'm going to miss out all of these things. I'm going to focus on this one thing and enjoy that a lot more. So you get more joy by missing out on the others.
I can get on this train, actually.
A couple of things that stuck with me when he speaks about attention is going back to this problem that just like how from the start of the industrial age, time is now considered a resource which you can barter. Attention has also become a resource. And And the problem with calling attention a resource, attention is your living breath. It is you. So your experience of being alive consists of nothing other than the sum of everything to which you pay attention. So when you pay attention to something you don't value, it's not an exaggeration to say that you're paying with your life.
Because what that means, if I'm hearing you right, is that every moment of your attention is what defines life. And the moment you barter your attention away into things that are vying for your attention, like social media, is designed with intention to steal your attention. When you trade your attention away to in social media, you are literally giving away your life.
Right. Right. Exactly. And also, you know, just to clarify, right? I'm not saying that, or the book is not saying that it's wrong to choose to spend your time relaxing or spend your time reading BuzzFeed news or whatever it is. So that's not the problem. If you choose to do that, choose to relax or choose to read, you know, whatever, page 3 news, it's fine. That's what you are choosing to spend your attention on that. But the problem these days is that you get distracted. So, and a distracted person isn't really choosing at all. Their attention has been commandeered by forces that don't have their highest interest at heart. Now, this is a problem. I mean, like when we are working on our laptops, you have the thing that you're working on, something you're reading, and then you have, say, like, I don't know, Instagram open or something like that. You know, and the Instagram feed is kind of bombarding you, right? And all these social media companies, they spend a ton of engineering resources on trying to figure out how they can commandeer your attention. And at that point, if you're just blindly scrolling, you got to be honest, you're not willingly spending time on that. I mean, you're getting dopamine hit after dopamine hit, and they're actually taken, you know, they created a successful distraction for you. And at that point, you're not choosing what to spend your attention on.
So the key thing here is choice, right? The choice to invest your time in a distraction. The distraction itself isn't the wrong thing here. It's the fact that you doing it on autopilot instead of choosing to do it is the problem. You mentioned another interesting thing along, you know, when you choose to relax. I think we should talk about what relaxation even means nowadays, you know, because Aristotle said that the greatest form of leisure is relaxation through self-reflection and, you know, philosophical contemplation. You know, he says sitting down and thinking about yourself, about things, is the greatest and the highest virtue for which all man has ever worked towards. Like, what is the point of becoming wealthy? So you can probably not work anymore. Okay, what are you going to do when you're not working anymore? Sit down and think and be with yourself and have the freedom to do whatever you want. But that is not happening anymore, right? When we go on vacation, it is always as a means to recover from work. If something bad has happened to you and you have to go on a vacation to recover from it. Or you go on vacation so that when you come back, you can work more. So it's always work-centric, and vacation is something to either escape from it or to go back into it with a better form. Right?
The purpose of leisure is self-improvement, right? The purpose of leisure is not just bumming around and doing nothing. You know, when I'm my leisurely activity is maybe reading a new technical textbook. But then the problem with that kind of a leisurely activity is, am I really getting a break? No, I'm using my brain juices, and I am using it for some other future reward again.
You are hoping that by reading that technical book, it will somehow pay off in your career later, in this job or the next or whatever it is.
So definitely in 2023, you're going to see me bumming around doing nothing a lot more.
You know, I learned a word through this book called atelic. He says, engage in atelic activities, which are activities that have no end goal in sight. They have no purpose other than doing it for what it is, like hiking. You're going to go to the top of the mountain and come back. The end result is known. You're not going to get anything out of it. But the happiness in hiking comes from the act of doing it at that moment. So, you know, find atelic activities to do that is just for the fun of doing it. It is not to any, you know, end goal. And I think, and if you find yourself being uncomfortable, like physically uncomfortable doing nothing for a period of time, then he says that you're doing it right. Face the discomfort of doing nothing. That is a very rare phenomenon these days.
I have a couple of more thoughts before we sign off. From past books, which are on the same topic of using your time wisely, one of the conclusions I kind of always come down to is that, hey, you know what? I need to go about life doing things that I enjoy so that, you know, when it's time for me to kick the bucket in my deathbed, whatever it is, or when I'm really old, I want to look back and reevaluate my life and feel like I have spent my time wisely. Thinking of experiences as you go through life that way is also problematic. Like if you're going through life with the thing that, hey, okay, you know what? I got to go to Europe. I want to gather all of these experiences because when I'm 80, I want to feel like I spent a good life. Okay. Most of us actually do, even the people who you know, quit the job and, you know, experience life, they are kind of going through life, accumulating experiences. And this act of accumulation is kind of problematic too. Because you're still not living. I mean, you may have quit your job, you may have done all the right things, but then again, you're living life, you're making choices from a point of view of a future reward that, hey, I want to feel like, you know, I've lived a good life. So the modern world provides an inexhaustible supply of things that seem worth doing. And the problem with this mindset of collecting experiences because you want to feel satisfied at the end of the life is really problematic, because if you have the mindset, you will never be satisfied. You'll always feel at the end of your life that, chah, I missed out on all of these experiences. So that's the problem with, you know, trying to accumulate and stuff experiences in your pocket.
Yeah, you can't get through all of them. I mean, even vacationing has its limits. You cannot go to every country in the world. You cannot go to every fancy destination and experience every fantastic activity in that place. It's just there is a limited amount of, even if you have unlimited money, there is limited time. That's what the whole takeaway from this book is. The reason this book has become so popular, it seems like, is that this is the only productivity book that accounts for the fact that, yes, there are limitations fundamentally to what you're doing. But as much as there are good things in this book, the book also towards the end starts to argue that there's something called the cosmic insignificance theory, where he argues that, look, in a cosmic scale, we are totally insignificant. And all of human civilization spans about 60 lifetimes. All of human civilization. And so somehow it is like a, there's a word for this. It's a nihilistic approach. It's a way to just roll over and give up sensation I get towards the end of the book. But my counter thought to that was, if all of human civilization is only 60 lifetimes, which is 5,000 years, right, roughly. If it's only 60 lifetimes, then mine being the 61st, isn't that cosmically insignificant? Okay, I mean, we haven't been around for billions of years. So, you know, in terms of the universe, of course, 80 years is nothing. It's not even a flash in the scale of time. But in terms of human civilization, I think one lifetime out of 60 is not a big fraction. So this whole approach of roll over and die doesn't float with me towards the end of the book. So I kind of feel like the book lost it towards the end for me. But definitely the first 60, 70% was full of valuable insights.
Yeah. Anywhere where the conclusion was, oh well, you know, you are like a grain of sand in the beach or whatever, and usually that one I kind of take it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, I mean, if all of human civilization had that approach, I mean, what is going to come of it? I mean, where are the greats then? You know, so do what you love. Yeah.
Yeah. You would just do nothing with your life essentially.
Yeah, then it'll be that philosopher on the beach story. Was it Socrates? You know, Alexander the Great comes and asks him, why are you sitting on the beach? Like, I mean, I'm happy. I'm just sitting on the beach. Then he asked Alexander the Great back the same question. So what do you want to do? Well, you know, why are you not on the beach? He's like, oh, I have to go conquer the world. Oh, and then what? Oh, I'm going to become the king of everything. And then what? Oh, I'll have all the resources, all the people, and all the greatness in the world, glory. And then what? And then he says, I can finally relax. So that's exactly what I'm doing now. You know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we don't have to take either extreme, I would say here. Okay. You don't have to lie on the beach all day or try to go conquer the world. Just take a middle path and find something that's meaningful for you to do. Yeah, that's what it is.
We'll call it on that. I think we've covered all our favorite points from it. So yeah, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. We will, you can hit us up on Instagram at halflife.show and go check out this book, 4,000 Weeks. I think I would definitely say it's one of the best books that I read in 2022. And I recommended this to a few friends and they all loved the book. So it's definitely a good reminder of how we should all rethink how we prioritize our life. All right. So until next time, bye-bye.